Welcome to Frankly Speaking on the TurfNet Radio Network. Here is your host, Dr. Frank Rossi.
Welcome to Frankly Speaking. I'm Frank Rossi, Cornell University and the TurfNet Radio Network. I'm joined today by Brian Whitlark, the USGA Senior Agronomist for the Southwest Region, Brian?
No senior before that title, just lowly agronomist.
Okay, so you're the lowly agronomist and you're working under the Senior Agronomist, the surfer dude, Pat Gross.
Yes, sir.
Is that our guy?
That's our guy, that's the man.
Man, he still looks like exactly the same when I saw him for the first time 30 years ago, doesn't he?
Yeah, minus the mustache, yeah. Looking good.
That's right. All right. So, Brian, like many of the USGA agronomists around the United States, service the golf industry in the United States in a variety of ways, from speaking engagements and course consultations to assisting with research. And, of course, in my favorite way that I know was started by the legendary Cornell guys back in the day that recently I knew as Jim Snow was absolutely nuts about the green section record. And so I'm still an avid reader of the record, even in its online format. It's a must read cover to cover. And Brian has written a couple of my most favorite articles in the last several years. And we had some interaction around the mowing article we're going to talk about, Brian. But let's talk about for a second this article you wrote back in November of 2012, Can't Stop Your Ball on the Green. I'm absolutely fascinated with the relationship between anything that helps define at a very fine level the interaction between the surface and the ball, because that is what I think these guys are constantly managing in one way, shape, or form. How does that ball interact with the surface? Because ultimately, that's what determines how successful or unsuccessful someone is in playing the game. So what motivated your interest in this? You said you had some interest in architecture and you had got a degree in meteorology and water, but what particularly interested in this other than you're probably a degenerate golfer from the Bay Area, right?
That's right. You know, this is kind of an interesting background story. So this started with when the topic of non-overseeding came up in the Southwest on putting greens. And there was some, a bar discussion that folks couldn't stop their ball on a non-overseeded putting green. So Rob Collins, who's a good friend of mine at Paradise Valley Country Club, one of the best superintendents that I work with, we had a discussion about this, and we engaged the golf professional there, and he said emphatically that, oh yeah, I can stop my ball on an overseeded putting green much better than I can on a non-overseeded surface. Like, well, that's interesting. Okay, let's take a look at that. So we have this USGA TrueFirm device, and I've used it on, 20 or so courses, both overseeded and non-overseeded greens, and by and large, the surface firmness of the non-overseeded surfaces was actually softer than on the overseeded surface. So it contradicts what this, what these professionals were saying. But nonetheless.
So hold on a second. Wait. A couple of things. First, a clarifying question.
Yes.
Are the non-overseeded greens painted?
Yes.
So they're all painted, which historically has made them faster, I think. I think the guys in the Southeast would tell me that their painted greens are pretty slick sometimes.
Yeah, but the paint doesn't have anything to do with that. At least I don't think it does. But you're right.
Okay. All right. So they're, because, guys that don't live in the overseeded world, we immediately think, well, is it brown? And I don't think everybody in the North, it's really resonated with them unless they're active golfers in the South during the winter, that painting is now the dominant, wouldn't you say? It's the dominant winter surface that they play on, isn't it?
In the Southeast, it is. Unfortunately, in the West, we haven't gotten there yet. Overseeding is still the way to go.
Okay, so that's the first question. The second question is, haven't we thought for a long time golf pros don't know what they're talking about?
Well, yeah.
I don't know. Did you actually have data about it now? I'm so glad to hear we've confirmed that suspicion.
So so we, Rob and I, you know, took him aside, said, all right, well, let's hit some wedge shots into this overseeded and non-overseeded nursery. And let's actually measure the bounce and roll. So he, that's what we did. That's how this all started. And the data from that was too, there was too much noise in the data. We couldn't pull out anything statistically. So,
well, probably because he doesn't hit a consistent shot.
That's exactly right. It wasn't consistent enough.
So you needed the, you needed that track device they use on TV.
We needed the ball machine. So that's when I talked to Dr. Pringle from USGA, and Matt said, oh yeah, we can do this. We can, you know, we know exactly the speed, the angle and the spin rate from a three iron all the way down to a sand wedge. And we can do it with extreme accuracy. So Matt sent this pitching machine out to Arizona, and he flew out. And we used this pitching machine instead of the pro to fire golf balls into this overseeded and non-overseeded surface. And we took green speed measurements. We took firmness measurements. And sure enough, we were able to, you know, I think we fired, gosh, almost 900 golf shots over 2 days into these two surfaces, both in the uphill and downhill direction. And, you know, long story short, the ball bounced and rolled out further on the overseeded surface because it was a little bit firmer than the non-overseeded surface. So that was one thing. The firmness had a significant impact on the golf ball bounce and roll, which you
right. Oh, hold on now. Okay. Right. Okay. Yep, right. Right. But I got to stop you here because that's in part of the article that I'm looking at that was another thing that jumped out at me. You know, first of all, your true firm values in the fours seems relatively soft relative to the values I often see that are in the twos. And sometimes as soft as in the threes, but it could be the difference between the spectrum true firm and the true firm you might be using. Or are you really telling me that a difference of, what did you find the difference here between 0.432 and 464 is what? 30, tens, hundredth, three hundredths of an inch.
So three hundredths is according to Dr. Pringle, 300s is a significant value. Now, in my experience, golfers, professional golfers, can detect a difference at about 0.03, 0.04 inches using the USGA TrueFirm. So it's debatable whether that 300s is detectable by the amateur golfer. Probably not.
But Pringle, the engineer, Dr. Pringle, our engineer here, yeah, says that that's significant softness.
Yes.
A difference in firmness. Yes. Now, that's the first thing. The second one is, let's talk about the way you shot the ball in before we get into sort of the results here. Because okay, this, to me, is also fascinating. Because, of course, we're interested in the way the green, you know, the shot is received. But when you look at the way these shots are coming out of the rough versus coming out of the fairway, and I'm assuming Matt has this data from measuring it, they always come out faster and a steeper angle with less spin, yeah, than they do when the ball's in the fairway.
Yeah, shallower angle.
Yeah, shallower angle, right, shallower angle. So that's what he's measured. So first of all, people need to understand how they are, in fact, penalized by hitting the ball in the taller grass. I mean, I don't think sometimes people think they should be able to hit the ball no matter what out of everywhere.
I agree.
and then you have architects, you know, that don't even put rough in there. You know, I work with Gil Hance. I see Doak doing it, Cor Crenshaw do it, where, you know, there's no rough at all. There's two mowing heights. There's the greens and everything else. And there's an argument to be made that actually moves the game along a little bit because they can always generally, if they're on a piece of grass, hit the ball in a pretty decent angle, all things considered, to get a decent result from the shot. I mean, that was the first. I thought that was fascinating in and of itself. Did you think much about that when you did this?
No, absolutely. Yeah, so, I mean, another reason why we did this is I get a lot of complaints from courses that from members that go along on these course visits that, hey, I can't stop my ball on the green. The greens are too firm. They always blame the greens. The greens are too firm. The greens are too firm. That's not the case. As you stated, you know, just a couple of minutes ago, these greens are soft. At 0.43 is a fairly soft, that is a receptive green. And that is very typical of Bermuda grass greens in the Southwest. It's very typical. Yet, I get these complaints from golfers. So part of this was to look at, all right, well, what if your golf ball comes in with less spin at a shallower angle, such as a shot played from the rough? Well, yeah, you don't have a chance, especially with slower spin.
That's exactly right. Well, and let's talk about the thing that's near and dear to your heart, the design of the course. You know, we're talking about pace of play and blah, blah, blah. And at some point, you know, I know that data is coming from you guys. I've seen some preliminary versions of it. But if in fact, you're in the rough and you know that this is going to happen to your shot, you need an entry point to the putting surface. And if you put lakes and bunkers and trees and rivers and mountains between that shot and the green, you know, your lie in the green, you're totally screwed, especially if the green is sloped away from you.
Absolutely. Or it's elevated, right? A lot of these greens, some of these courses up in Scottsdale, they're all pitched up. So you can't land the ball on the approach and get it to bounce up onto the green.
Let me take a left turn here with you, because I know you have some interest in architecture. Could you imagine that the full communication of this data could lead to golf course, you know, data-driven golf course design? Imagine if a golf course architect, a modern golf course architect, and maybe some do. I think Gil, and I know I work closely enough with Gil and Jim Wagner at the Hance Design, and I know they're using data. But do you get architects looking at this data saying, listen, here's how you have to design these courses, especially you and I know we're not talking about spring chickens playing those golf courses in Arizona in the winter, are we?
No, these are mature golfers with slower swing speeds, to put it nicely, I guess.
Right.
You know, it's a good question.
That's very well done.
I haven't had any discussions with golf course architects about this data, only just trying to support superintendents who are getting these complaints that the greens are too firm, and they share this data with their members. Says, hey, look, if the green is unapproachable, if the approach is pitched steeply towards the player and you have to land the ball on the green, and the green is pitched away from the player, it's going to be tough to stop your ball on the green, especially if you're hitting the ball at a low inbound angle, which these golfers with the slower swing speeds, they're not hitting the ball that comes in at a 50, 60 degree landing angle. You know, it's 30, 35 degrees. And with that type of inbound angle, it's really tough to stop the ball on the green. So they're using that data to say, look, here's the data that it's not just the firmness of the greens, it's the pitch of the greens. And you, the golfer, are really responsible for how your ball stops on the green. You know, it is what it is. Sorry, guys.
It's such a great discussion. And I want to listen, before we take a break, our first break of the show, I want to ask you about the relationship with ball roll. I mean, one of the things you did say in this article clearly is that, you know, ball roll didn't seem to come into this. And so that doesn't surprise either of us. I mean, to a certain extent, I think that if you've got a surface with not a lot of friction on it, if you, you know, and I'm assuming a faster green theoretically might have less friction, there's some evidence that would suggest if you're spinning it more on a low friction thing, you're still going to get some benefit from it. But that wasn't the case in this study. But I'm worried. The thing I want to ask you about is the mindset. When people play on fast greens, which these are, they're also very soft greens by my estimation.
Yeah.
How confused does it does the golfer get? Again, in your thing, when you blame the green for it, I want to turn it around and say, well, green speed, you want fast greens. I'm giving you that. This is a whole nother thing. How do you reconcile the ball roll conversation and the firmness conversation with the golfer and the golf superintendent?
Yeah, so in this study, the first day, the green speed was, I think, a foot difference. I think it was 12.3 or something like that versus 11.3. And we didn't see any statistical difference in the golf ball bounce and roll. So that's what the data says. Yet, in conversations with golfers and even professional golfers at the highest level, they have an incorrect view, which is interesting, of green speed and firmness. So 2 years ago.
Well, let's just say a misperception.
Misperception, thank you, yes. So a couple of years ago, I had the Senior Open at Oak Tree National in Edmond, Oklahoma. And it was Scott Verplank had just turned 50 years old. It was his first Senior Open. He lives, actually got a house on the golf course. And so he's up on the putting green, and I have an opportunity to have a little conversation with him. And we were discussing firmness versus speed. And he's asking me a little bit about firmness. I'm testing the firmness on the green. I'm like, oh yeah, you know, as the day progresses, the greens will firm up as the greens dry out. And he said, well, what about the speed? I said, well, we are losing about a foot of speed throughout the day. And he kind of looked at me with a puzzled look. I said, well, you know, what do you think about that? He said, well, you know, is the greens, you know, it's super windy in Edmond. It was hot. And they get, he called it crispy. Well, the greens are going to get crispy and they get scarier. They get faster. I said, you know, Mr. Verplank, you know, I hate to break the news to you, but, you know, I've already got 5 days of data here at this site, and every day we're losing about a foot of speed, sometimes 16 inches of speed from morning to the afternoon. And he just walked away. He didn't want to hear any more of that.
Yeah, and it is exactly at the heart of what we're talking about here, Brian. Listen, we've got to wrap up this segment and go to a message, but I want to give you the last word about this, because before we go to the break, if the people at the highest level, who I would say in many ways can perceive a lot of things about a golf course that is informative to a golf course superintendent, and you know, you got to assume that, you know, these people are practicing their craft at the highest level, and therefore the average, even if not the slightly above average American golfer, these things are completely imperceptible to them. And so what do you think, with that as a backdrop, that no matter, we have data that contradicts their perception, what's the most effective way to tell them that?
Gosh, you know,
nothing but the tough questions here on Frankly Speaking, yeah, Dr.
No
Whitlark.
You know, I think it would go a long way if the TV commentators who, right or wrong, hold a lot of credibility with the golfing audience, if they would tell the true story, I think that would actually help. Because I've tried, you know, in articles, in discussions at green committees, and some golfers are very much willing to listen. Kevin Sutherland is another professional golfer who's actually on the green committee at Del Paso Country Club in Sacramento. He's one that has been really interested in these conversations and willing to listen, and has actually shared some of this information with some of his colleagues. And Kevin is one of the best players on the senior tour. So there's some golfers that are willing to listen, but others, you know, for whatever reason, aren't willing to listen. But if Frank Nobolo and the boys on the Golf Channel and stuff would actually tell the true story, that would help. But they don't.
But I, Yeah. Well, and I would say this. I would say we've not been effective in telling that story in a way that fits into the story they're trying to tell. And the story I think they're trying to tell is moving more and more towards analytics and like I said earlier, that data driven stuff, the whole idea of big data. If we can provide this data on a regular basis, wouldn't it be cool that during the day they actually started to show that data along the side? You know how they do that stupid little thing in the beginning? Oh, here's the course and who designed it and the grass is on it and here's the golf superintendent. And then they write that Poana stuff, which, you know, I love. They don't, you know, it's poorly done. And what if we provided them that data about shot angle? Here's the shot angle he's hitting. Here's the slope of this green and the chances that this is going to happen unless he gets a lot of spin on it out of that rough. Da 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 da. I think we're getting closer to that. You're not going to get a chance to comment on that, Brian, because this is Frankly Speaking, and we got to take a break and get for a message from our sponsors. And when we come back, we're actually going to take a complete right turn and talk about a little bit deeper work on putting surfaces, and that is mower setup. I'm Frank Rossi. I'm with Brian Whitlock, the agronomist in the Southwest region of the United States for the United States Golf Association on TurfNet Radio.
Golf course superintendents, now you can aerate and fill 9 inches to 11 inches deep with minimal surface disruption and cleanup. The Maximus Deep Aeration Instant Fill Service from Dryject injects 1 pound of sand per square foot, 22 tons per acre, and leaves surfaces ready for play again in 1 hour. Best of all, Maximus by Dryject is only half the cost of alternative deep aeration and fill technologies. Visit MaximusAeration.com to locate your nearest Maximus by Dryject service center.
Welcome back to Frankly Speaking. I'm Frank Rossi on the TurfNet Radio Network, joined by Brian Whitlock, agronomist in the Southwest region of the United States Golf Association's Green Section, visiting golf courses, and as we were finding earlier, writing exceptionally well-done articles and of really cool topics. I have all I do not to spend 40 minutes talking about what we just talked about there and have you back for this mower thing at another time. But I do want to talk about the mower stuff, because as you transition from what we were talking about earlier, where I leave it with exactly what I think you leave it with, is a bit perplexed as to what the differences in perception between what we're measuring and what should be happening to what people think is happening and what should be happening. And a lot of that, as we talked about, is related to the surface preparation. And probably nothing is more important in surface preparation on a putting surface than mowers and mowing quality. And Brian, I guess I want to start out this conversation based on the article that you published in February of 2016 in the Green Section. Were you surprised when you began to write this article how little there was known about putting green mowing?
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I think that I learned a heck of a lot. And I have to, thank the golf course superintendents and Tom Langworthy from Toro are really, helping me learn more about this subject. Rodney Lingle, who's formerly at Memphis Country Club, now he's down in Houston. Rob Collins at Paradise Valley Country Club. They were extremely helpful in, experimenting with some things to learn more about how mower setup influences the quality of the putting surface. Really, I found it extremely fascinating. And as I discuss this topic on my course visits, I find it interesting that, there's many courses that don't give this enough thought and discussion between the superintendent and the equipment manager. And I guess if nothing else comes out of this discussion, it's just to raise the awareness for superintendents and equipment managers to regularly engage in discussions about the quality of cut, the aggressiveness of the mower, how it impacts, how sand top dressing influences the quality of cut, and go out and look at the greens through a prism gauge. Don't be afraid to go out and run some little experiments, play around with the mower setup and measure how it influences the quality of the greens. It's really fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, let me tell you, it's funny that you bring this up, and I had a good, well, I would say didn't start out great, but ended really well relationship with, I'm just so thankful, as you are, to people like, it was at Langworthy at Toro that you mentioned, those types of guys in those companies that really want to work to help people understand the technology. When I worked with Van Klein years ago on a mower setup trial that, you know, you reported in this article, and that I think Sorokin and Nikolai did a wonderful job in following up on, how much adjustments you can, how many adjustments you can make to these mowers. I think when we started with Van Klein, he was telling me the Flex 21 had 27 different setups that you could set that mower with, different bed knife positions and rear roller positions. So that's a very salient point that you would say. One of the things that comes from this article is that you should play around with your mowers a little bit, but wouldn't you say there's great fear among superintendents to do that?
Oh yeah, because when Toro sends you a mower, they send it out with the least aggressive setting, right? With a red bed bar, with no shims on the rear roller, and the John Deere mowers generally are pretty a non-aggressive mower setup. And that's kind of the easy button, right? So, but if you've got a nursery green, you got a chipping green, take the mower out and mow a few passes at that less aggressive setting and set it up more aggressively. Put some shims, if you got the Toro machines, put some shims on the rear, look at a different bed knife, change the frequency of clip, and measure that. Look at the prism gauge, measure clippings, even double mowing, honestly. So you take the prism gauge out. You look at the prism gauge in the morning before you've mown, and it's at 120 in the prism gauge. You mow the green and it's at 105. And then you double mow it and it goes down another 10 thousandths of an inch. I found that fascinating.
Yes. And so to get, okay, so that's the application of this. We actually, that's so great. We started sort of at the end. That's exactly where we should end up, that guys should be playing around. But let's do a little bit of a dive here into the work. And as you organized it, very similar to the way I've thought about it. There's, is the stuff that's doing the clipping sharp? What is the relationship between those two pieces of one of them spinning and another piece of stationary metal? And then how is that affected by the ground speed and the spinning speed of that piece of metal reel spinning around? So let's start with sharpness. I know you didn't want to get into it in your article, and I'm not going to press you on it, but wouldn't you say the big debate is between contact, no contact, spin grind, backlap. Where do you took a pretty straight line through this, which I would expect from a good solid USGA agronomist. I don't want you to depart too much from that if you're uncomfortable doing so, but you've obviously played around with this and been doing your own experimenting. You've formed an opinion. I'd like to hear what it is with regard to, producing and maintaining the most consistently sharp cutting surfaces. Because there's no argument, sharpness is king.
Sharpness is king, absolutely. You use less fuel with a sharp mower. That was clear. I think one thing that I found interesting was, there's the semantics of the relationship between the reel and the bed knife vary. So, in other words, some people refer to no contact or light contact, but what does that mean? And one thing I stressed in the article that John Daniels and I stressed in the article was to, rather than say contact, talk about clearance and put a value on that. So talking to the manufacturers, they suggest anywhere from, I think it was about 0.0005 inches to 0.002 inches of clearance. And that can be measured or set with a feeler gauge, right? And so rather than say that's light contact or no contact, use a feeler gauge to measure that. And the one study that they did on fuel, it was not only the sharp equipment, but light contact at, you know, 0.002 of an inch utilized less fuel than heavy contact, which may be, I don't know, 0.0003 or you know, something that, you know.
Right.
But, you know, and I remember discussing with Mr. Langworthy, they had suggested that too light of contact, in other words, or too light of clearance, greater than 0.0002 was unadvisable because it left stragglers. You didn't get as good of a quality of cut. So I guess I'd start there and just stress that when you're looking at contact, look at clearance and use a feeler gauge to make sure that you have a measured amount of clearance between the reel and the bed knife.
So just to be clear about this, just thinking about how this could happen, the idea that there would be greater clearance leads to more fuel consumption. Did I hear that right?
No, it was less, well, tight clearance. And it wasn't defined in that study. There wasn't a value assessed to the clearance in that fuel study. But from what I gather, it was pretty tight. Again, I wish they had assessed the value to it, but they didn't.
Right. Okay. So for sure, there seems to be the need, number one, to know that clearance with a easy to obtain feeler gauge.
Yeah.
And making sure that they're sharp. So that is one thing to start. I've always been fascinated with how these things sort of progress over time. I mean, we've done some mower work, Brian. They start out sharp. We ran them literally for 40 minutes. And sometimes, depending on the distance from the last sand top dressing,
right.
But even when they are sand, even when the sand isn't around, it's not uncommon for mowers to lose that sharpness straight away. Did you learn something in your exploration that suggested there was one way better than another to maintain those sharp reels?
Well, I'd say two things. One is relief. You need 15, 20 degrees of relief to minimize the landing angle or the contact between the reel and the bed knife and other materials. You know, sand is certainly one. So maintaining some amount of relief as well as on the reel, as well as is important to, let's see, I lost my train of thought. Sorry.
No worries. So you have the relief on the, and then the face of the bed knife, I'm assuming is what you were going to say.
Well, right? It has to be, there's that ejection angle and the presentation angle on the bed knife need to be maintained. Oh, and then, the other one that I really wanted to talk about was backlapping. So this was an interesting topic because in my area, backlapping has really fallen out of favor. Yet when I was traveling to the Midwest, nearly everyone that I talked to was backlapping. I said, what is going on? And then when I talked to some of the engineers, they really suggested backlapping. So again, I got to thank Rob over at Paradise Valley Country Club. He said, all right, well, let's take a look at this, because they weren't backlapping. You know, they were only grinding, right? So then they took some mowers, and in addition to grinding, they backlapped on a daily basis for 3 to 5 minutes. And sure enough, they found that those mowers maintained a sharper edge for longer in between grinds with backlapping. So if you're point blank asked me, I'd say, look, I would definitely backlap on a frequent basis every day, but only for a couple minutes, using a fine grit backlapping compound like the 220, and grind as well. So you really need to do both. One or the other, in my opinion, is no good. But the backlapping helps to extend the life of the reel and the bed knife between grinding events.
And so I'll take my typical, you know, sarcastic approach here and say, would you say that the people who sell grinders are a little bit more effective selling them in some areas versus others?
Probably, yes. But they're needed everywhere.
All right, so that's exactly right. It's not, and I don't, that's the thing. We're not suggesting, I don't hear you suggesting that a mower never needs to be ground.
No.
But the idea that we've abandoned, I think we've abandoned backlapping completely for grinding. I'm so glad you have these superintendents working with you in this thoughtful way, because it's exactly what sort of moves the needle on some of these issues when these guys sort of see it for themselves and they need a little help from, you know, this is a great role for the agronomists, for you guys to be playing. You're sort of like acting like extension associates or extension specialists out in the area doing this really practical research. And let's talk about the next batch of work that, if I had to rate the impactful things in mower setup, I would say the most important thing is the relationship between the bed knife and the center line of the reel. I think you can get by with dull mowers for a little while. You can get by with various frequencies of clip at periods of time. But if that bed knife to reel relationship where the bed knife comes straight back makes for a very aggressive cut, if you're not aware that's happening, I've seen it lead to basal rod anthracnose that almost cost a few guys their jobs. So would you agree with me, or am I going too far with this?
Well, I remember our discussion, you know, a year ago or 2 years ago when you had mentioned the anthracnose. I haven't seen that. And to be honest, I'm relatively confident that the aggressive setup provides a cleaner surface over time. However, I don't have any data to support that. And the research that you mentioned doesn't really support that either. It does collect more clippings. And I've done some additional work with superintendents after that article was written on this subject of looking at non-aggressive versus aggressive setup. And even when we adjust the height of cut with the aggressive setup up 20, 30, even 40 thousandths of an inch, a lot of times we still collect more clippings than at the lower height of cut with the aggressive, with the less aggressive setup. So over time, it stands to reason that more aggressive setup is going to provide a faster surface, is going to provide a cleaner cut. However, I don't have any strong data to support that. And there's no research that, to my knowledge, that supports that either.
Certainly we had periods of time, Brian, when we did our bed knife positioning work, where we found some differences in ball roll. I don't think Sorokin and Nikolai concluded at all that an aggressive setup did anything more than collect a whole lot of sand, especially if done close to a sand top dressing, which, you know, I didn't look at that. We didn't necessarily always find more clippings either. I can't remember whether they did or not. But what I worry about, I mean, here's the bottom line for me. If you're going to be more aggressive, our work showed you could get away with it in most climates where there's not a lot of stress pretty well. So I would substantiate your claim to some degree, or support your claim, that you're going to have cleaner surfaces, maybe faster surfaces, but I would argue a little more stressed. It seemed like a little more stressed that I observed anyway, but only when you only observed it when the plant was under other kinds of stress, right? Environmental stresses, heat and drought, and, you know, persistent humidity that it wouldn't break. So, That's the only thing that concerns me. And yet in your climate, I think partly it's because you guys are dry and really good waterers. I would say unless that other superintendent you worked with, Rodney, was in a climate that was different, where he would see some stress to his grasses.
No, I don't believe so. You know, he was in Memphis and now he's down in Houston. And it turns out, and this actually really surprised me researching this article, the John Deere, you know, 220C mower is not aggressive. I was under the impression that it was an aggressive mower, but after learning more about it, and there's a table in that article that we provided that shows the behind center distance and the angle of attack of the bed knife of, you know, four different mowers, and that John Deere mower was the least aggressive of the four with that particular setup. So turns out that you know, Rodney actually was using a mower with a low level of aggressiveness, if you will.
Huh.
So another, and I'll
now.
Well, go ahead.
The other part I wonder that comes into this, and it isn't in your thing here, and I did it only the first time I was evaluating mower differences. The John Deere head, and I would even say the current flex head that Toro's using, seems heavier now. I don't think we're afraid of making heavy, heavy reels anymore, heavy cutting units anymore for the putting surface. I think you could be right that John, you know, this data is clear. It's less aggressive from a bed knife setup. I've often wondered if it isn't heavier. And, you know, that point of attack is going to be influenced by, of course, the other things we're not even talking about, which is firmness and other things we talked about in the first part of our chat today, but also the weight of the mower. There really isn't necessarily an easy way to assess that other than maybe if we've put pressure, found a way to put pressure plates, put these mowers on pressure plates and figure out how they're attacking the canopy, like the way a footprint works on a ground. You know, if you put it on a pressure plate, is there a relationship between the softness of the green or the weight of the cutting head and the angle of attack? Because we saw anthracnose when the greens got soft and we had the aggressive angle.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I know that John Deere mower is a heavy, if it's a fixed head and it's there's a lot of down pressure. It's interesting, the Flex 21 mower is a heavy mower. However, the down pressure where the reel meets the bed knife is less than the Toro 1000. Even though the Toro 1000 is a lighter head, the down pressure is greater. And
right, because it's a fixed head mower. Yeah, it's that particular design, I think, is their front weight bias that gives it that, how they position the weight over, that they're really moving the center of gravity really over that reel, so that it's a very aggressive cut. But you know, well, you're so young, you probably can't remember, but I can remember when we used to cut greens much higher and you wanted that heavy, you know, weight, because it did two things. That was the best tracking mower I ever chased. You could chase it and it tracked really well. And then of course, greens weren't as well top dressed and things, they raised the height of cut. And you put the down pressure, they used to believe that helped control thatch, right? Because Toro had the old 500 that they used to refer to as the Thatch Master, had that little bicycle reel inside that head. So things have come a long way with the way we design the heads, not just for their ability to be adjusted, the bed knife position. I'm curious, some more thoughts you have about weight.
Well, you mentioned something about thatch, and there are some who believe that the fixed head mower, given its greater down pressure, helps sort of prevent thatch, where the lighter weight floating head mowers kind of ride on top of the thatch. So that's one opinion out there. Now, I've seen some really darn good putting surfaces mown with floating head mowers. So that hasn't been my observation in the field. Again, it makes sense intuitively. It makes sense that the greater the down pressure, you're going to get a better quality of cut. and you may have less thatch than on a, with a floating head. But I can't say that I've observed that in the field. One other thing I guess I want to mention is the difference between the bench setting and the effective height of cut. When I go to course visits, they all want to know, well, what are the course, what is this course mowing at? Well, all, for all the reasons that we're discussing, there's so many variables that go into determining the effective height of cut. In other words, the height of cut in the field. And it's different for every golf course. So trying to translate the bench setting of a mower from one course to another is essentially useless. I don't care what they're mowing at across the street. What does your prism gauge say? And what are the green speeds? You know, just try to encourage superintendents to get away from the
right. Well, that's exactly right. And I think what you're observing here as we wrap up for today, Brian, and I'll thank you in advance as I make this last comment, and I made it earlier in our earlier conversation. Data is going to take this thing over. And I think the reason they're still talking about heights of cut is, you know, for a long time, Brian, that's the only number we had. It's like same thing with soil testing. People fertilized a lot because it was the only number they had. So they used it and we had ball roll because it was the only number we had. And now we're going to be inundated with data that we didn't even think was possible to know. You know what I mean? And so what used to be a discussion about height of cut is you're going to characterize your surface with, oh, what's your surface performance index these days, right? And that's going to be a conglomeration of firmness, ball roll, how the mower responds to the surface, the relationship between your mower and the surface, the rolling, the top dressing. All those things are going to be data that's going to be knowable at our fingertips and easy to interpret. That's why what you're doing here with both of these studies that you wrote about, one with John Daniels and one with Matt Pringle, got caught my interest because they're areas where data tells such a fascinating story that really doesn't get told very much, whether it's the imperceptions, the misperceptions between what a golfer thinks and the surface, and the misperceptions that superintendents have when they talk about mowing heights place to place. So, you know, as we wrap up as an agronomist traveling around, what do you think, how are we going to make this transition to having more data and changing these conversations? As you and I know, writing an article is not going to do it. What do you think is going to move this along? Is it TV commentators for this? Do we want Johnny Miller talking about bench settings and effective height of cut?
Absolutely not, no. But I, you know, to try to answer that, I think it's greens benchmarking, right? So you know, we're already collecting. Many courses are collecting moisture data on a daily basis. They're collecting green speed on a daily basis, maybe firmness. Eventually, we'd like to be able to quantify smoothness, which may be more important than anything. But I think, you know, collectively gathering this data and relating it to mower setup and moisture management and top, you know, all the management tools that we use, I think that's where we're headed, and it's something that I'm certainly interested in, and I try to do as much as I can with that, with the courses that I work with, and just collecting data and evaluating the progress from one year to the next. You know, are we improving the organic matter management? Are we improving the speed of the greens, the smoothness of the greens? But if we don't, without the data, right, you're just guessing.
Yeah. Well, and of course, that's what our industry for many years has been based on, because it didn't seem that much of this data was knowable nor relevant. So it's very funny as I wrap up with you, Brian, how, you know, there's the perceptions, right? And you and I would call them alternative facts, right? The perceptions that golfers and superintendents might have. In fact, what they think is true is the alternative to what data is now revealing to us.
Absolutely.
Okay. Brian Whitlark, agronomist for the United States Golf Association in the Southwest region. Brian, thanks so much for taking the time to join me on Frankly Speaking. I hope we get a chance to talk again about this green benchmarking tool. I know the RNA has played around with that over the years, and I'm assuming the USGA is going to have their hand in this associated with the resource management tool that you guys are releasing. So I'm sure you're going to be busy talking about this more in the future.
Yes, sir. Thanks so much for your time. It was fun being here.
Thank me. Thank you for your time. Brian Whitlock here with me on Frankly Speaking, smart talk from leading thinkers.
You have been listening to Frankly Speaking with host Dr. Frank Rossi on TurfNet Radio Network. Check back for schedules on future programs. Thanks for tuning in.